The X-Files has two characters. They both approach their FBI investigations with different perspectives. In the movie that came out in the late 90s, the motion picture, they wanted to be able to appeal to a more broad audience, and so they kind of introduced themselves in the opening dialogue. And the scene is that the FBI is searching at a building in Dallas where they've gotten a bomb threat. But Mulder and Scully are in the building across the street searching around. And Scully says, "Mulder, when a terrorist bomb threat is called in, the rational purpose of providing that information is to allow us to find the bomb. The rational object of terror is to promote terror. If you'd study the statistics, you'd find the modal behavior pattern for virtually every case where a threat has turned up an explosive device. And if we don't act in accordance with that data, if we ignore it, as we have done, the chances are great that if there actually is a bomb over there, we might not find it." And Mulder sneaks up behind her and scares her. And he says this, "Whatever happened to playing a hunch, Scully? The element of surprise, random acts of unpredictability. If we fail to anticipate the unforeseen or unexpected, or the unexpected in a universe of infinite possibilities, we might find ourselves at the mercy of anyone or anything that cannot be programmed, categorized, or easily referenced." Then we have Thomas. Thomas, who is a man that I'm making the case for today that is of two minds, that bridges this gap. Yes, he is popular for being the one who doubted, but he is also the one that once he did see, once Jesus appeared before him, he did believe. As we said in the skit last week at the sunrise service, Thomas was one that wanted to believe. He wanted to believe, but his mind won't let him. Right, Thomas? Your mind wouldn't let you. And in years past, I've portrayed him as a sympathetic figure because, after all, he wasn't there. Everyone else was having a party without him. Jesus appeared, and he was not there. Wouldn't any one of us have done the same thing, asked the same questions? I've made the case before that he is the 21st century disciple in a first century garb. He is the questioner. He is smart, educated. He depends on empirical evidence. He's the Scully to make judgment calls. But I think deep down, he really wanted to believe, as evidence, because he did not have to touch the wounds of Jesus. He did not. It was enough for him that Jesus came and appeared. At the start of the story, he is where many of us are today, right? We're stuck in a world of rationality, of empirical evidence, of 2 + 2. Equals 4. But since we're all here, I think we yearn for much, much more. Thomas is of two minds, like this coin. I'm making the argument today that faith, on the one hand, needs doubt on the other. Doubt, questions. How do we come to faith to begin with? We come to it by questions. Rabbi Irwin Kula, who is a rabbi in New York City, has written a book called Yearnings. I've referred to this before. In one of the last chapters, he talks about the yearning for transcendence. And there was some good stuff in there as it relates to this story. And he was talking about the scenarios of how you might discover that the tooth fairy does not exist. Each of us would have a different story. There's three general scenarios that he describes for us. Number one, the first is that an 8-year-old, and 8-year-olds are about the range where kids are losing their teeth, starting to question the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus and all that. So an 8-year-old figures out one day that there is no tooth fairy and goes to his mom, right? Says, I don't believe that there's a tooth fairy. You are doing it. And the mother reacts strongly to the negative, saying, of course there is a tooth fairy, but now that you don't believe in the tooth fairy is not going to come see you anymore. Anyone had that experience? Kind of gets you out of that, right? Since you don't believe anymore, the tooth fairy is not going to come. The second scenario is that the 8-year-old figures out there's no tooth fairy, goes to mom, and mom says, oh, I forgot, honey. But now you're kind of too old for that tooth fairy thing. So the mother gives him a dollar, says to put it in his bank, save it for the future, something practical, right? Something mature and grown up. The third scenario is that the 8-year-old figures out there's no tooth fairy. And instead of just reacting strongly to the negative or acknowledging the fact that there isn't one and moving on to the next phase of life, mom looks knowingly and maybe a little bit sad. And she goes to a box that she was keeping in her room. And inside the box were all the boy's teeth that she had collected over the years playing the tooth fairy. And she shows him all the teeth. And she asks him the question, what do you think the tooth fairy does with all of these lost teeth that is collected? And then next week, he loses another tooth, and there is a dollar under the pillow. In our world, the first way of reacting represents sort of the literal, fundamental belief that is out there in the Bible, in God. And the upside is that it can be incredibly uplifting and reassuring and hopeful, optimistic even for us to think, to live in that world of pure belief, right? But the downside is that it can be judgmental once we begin to ask those honest questions and we are excluded, right? Since you don't believe anymore, since you have doubts and questions, you're shut out of God's grace. And that's the way we've treated, traditionally, the story of Thomas. Don't doubt, but believe. And even if you haven't seen, believe anyway. That's the traditional interpretation of Thomas, of the story of the doubting Thomas. The second scenario of the tooth fairy scenario represents for us today our efforts to try to protect ourselves from disillusionment and to mature quickly, to have our children mature more rapidly. The upside is that this encourages us to grow up, to yearn to probe and to question things. Thomas certainly had these qualities. He didn't want a blind faith. We should want this too. We should not want a blind faith. Yes, Jesus says, blessed are we who are living here in the 21st century who have not seen Jesus and seen his wounds and been able to touch them. But shouldn't we want to see God? To see God where we can see God, to see the miraculous risen Savior in our midst? We should want that. How do we achieve that? Well, Jesus himself says that ask, to seek and you will find. Ask and it shall be given to you. So there is a place in our faith to explore, to ask those questions. Thomas is rewarded for this, despite this monocle, this title of doubter that we put on him. He's rewarded. Jesus appears to him, answers his questions. And Thomas would go on, as legend has it, to be a man of great faith, a disciple who traveled all the way eastward to India to spread the faith of Jesus Christ. And there's good evidence, archaeological evidence, empirical evidence to suggest that he did make it to India, that Christianity was spread to much greater part of the world than we knew at the time. Now, the downside to the number two view of looking at things, of reacting this way, is that it provokes cynicism. Because what happens when we don't get the answers that we seek? So many of us are here at this point in life. Many of us are stuck in questions. Many of us are stuck in doubt. Many of us cannot get beyond touching and seeing and having to see to believe. Many of us are stuck never to cross over, to be comfortable with our questions and the mysteries at the same time, to hold those two together. Intention, the empirical and the magical, the mystical and the pragmatic, the fantastic and mundane, the idealistic and the realistic, the ordinary and the enchanted. We live in a disenchanted world. Disenchanted. More information, but less love. Less love. The third way of reacting to the tooth fairy is the way to go, I believe. The way that I'm making a case for today. The way that Thomas approached his faith. To ask the questions and then to believe. There will always be more out there. As Paul says, we only see dimly through the glass. Number one and number two are at war with each other in this world. They call each other names. We call the people who are in this number one world of just believe, naive, hopelessly naive. We call people who are in this number two, in this empirical world of atheism, just chillingly sophisticated, without any warmth. We yearn for something in between. We yearn for a balance. We yearn for a more expansive view that pushes the boundaries of our belief. These beliefs, these Sunday school stories that we learned. The second naivety that Rabbi Kula talks about means to push back our beliefs. Not to push them away, but to expand our beliefs, to build off of our beliefs, to reconstruct them, to give us meaning. It is passionate humility, passionate of the number one view of looking at the world, that passion and optimism with the humility of being able to deconstruct something and ask the questions. This is the place we should aim for, a place of hope. This is the faith of Thomas. We focused on the doubt. We need to also remember his faith. And by the way, the partnership between Scully and Mulder, well, they found the bomb in the building where the rest of the FBI was checking, where the evidence suggested, where the data suggested that it would be. But it was in an unexpected place in that building, in the snack machine, where they had put it. Let's be disciples like Thomas, be of two minds, questioners, explorers, so that we can have a deeper faith. A faith that becomes all the more real for us because Jesus comes.